This is a reading of a set of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled Bees. Lecture 4 was given in Dornach, December 5, 1923. It begins with an explanatory introduction by the editors. Mr. Erbsmail states that beekeepers today are primarily concerned with the profits gained from beekeeping. Every effort is directed toward this materialistic goal. In the titled Swiss Apiculture newspaper, No. 10, October 1923, you will find the following statement, quote, "Honey is, for the most part, a luxury item, and those who purchase it can afford to pay a good price for it," unquote. Later on, in the same newspaper, an example is given of a certain Mr. Baldensberger, who traveled throughout Spain and on one occasion found a group of very healthy children assembled about a beekeeper. He asked the beekeeper, "Whom do you sell your honey to?" The beekeeper immediately replied, "These are my customers." Here in the heart of Europe, the goal is to get as much out of the honey as possible. An employer's main interest is to see how much labor can be gotten out of the employees. The same applies also to the bees. Another question is posed as to whether there might be any truth to the opinion expressed by some that moonlight has a certain influence on the formation of nectar in flowers, number 11 of the same newsletter. Mr. Müller responds that Mr. Erbsmail can easily see from reading the apicultural newspaper that it can only be a beekeeper with a small number of hives who doesn't sell any honey at all. Mr. Erbsmail simply doesn't know yet how much is presently involved in a beekeeping operation, and that a certain amount of bookkeeping is necessary. If you don't plan financially for some profit in this venture, just as you would in any other enterprise, then you'd simply have to give up beekeeping. The large quantity of honey available commercially would not be there if you didn't obtain honey that was produced by artificial breeding in this way. Sometimes the yield is only 1 to 2 kilos of honey. Under certain conditions, it even contains some fir tree honey, which you have to remove if you want to keep the bee colonies healthy. That's all. After that, there may be a bad year, and you won't have enough to last until April or May. You'll need to use artificial feeding, sugar, chamomile tea, thyme, and some salt, in order to get the bee colonies through a difficult period, so as to maintain them in a state of continuous vitality. In a modern beekeeping operation, you need to keep a record of how much time the beekeeper has worked, 5.5 hours at the going rate of 1 or 1.5 Swiss francs. Then the honey would have to be sold at a price of 7 Swiss francs. You can also count on losses. You may lose the framework for the honeycomb and then have to replace something. The whole thing has to turn a profit. If a beekeeper were only to stick to the old way of doing things, then the beekeeper wouldn't make any progress. Mr. Erbsmail can do that with his small operation, but if you have a large number of hives, then you have to sit down and figure out that you have already incurred a deficit when you ask 6 Swiss francs. The American beekeepers do it the same way. Mr. Müller cannot comprehend that the bee colonies may die out in 80 or 100 years. He simply can't understand how Dr. Steiner can say that, in 50 or 100 years, artificial breeding can cause serious problems for the bee colonies to which it has been applied. In regard to the second point about announcing the death of the beekeeper to the bees, he already mentioned that the greatest portion of the hives died out when the beekeeper who tended them died. Just how this can happen, he simply can't comprehend. About the adulterated or artificially made honey in hotels, he wants to add that first-class hotels are, in many instances, selling American honey. If you feed European bees this honey, which is, after all, a bee product, they die. Then there is this matter about the bees stinging. Perspiration is about the worst thing for bees, and if you hear whistling, rattling, or any strident sound, it is advisable to remain standing and not move. And then And then with reference to the question that asks about the effect of a bee sting on a human being, he relates one example that he knew about personally. A strong man was stung by a bee. He cried out, "Hold me, I've been stung by a bee." He was extraordinarily sensitive, allergic to bee stings. He also had heart disease. He suggests that Dr. Steiner could explain how a bee sting can pose such a great danger to certain human beings. There is, for example, a saying, if a horse is stung 3 times by hornets, the horse will die. Some time ago in one of his hives, he says he found a hornet's nest. He simply removed the brood. The hornets were so cowardly that they didn't sting in the dark. Outside, they probably would have done so. Now, Dr. Steiner begins speaking. Let's investigate, so that we can discuss this matter rationally, how bees can recognize the beekeeper who tends them. You passed judgment on this matter based on your normal understanding of such things, and this is completely justified. But now I want to tell you something. Imagine that you have a friend with whom you became acquainted in, let's say, 1915, Table 7, page 164. This friend remains here in Europe, and you go to America and return again in 1925. Your friend, let's assume, lives in Arlesheim, where you happen to see him and recognize him and remember who he is. But what has happened meanwhile? I've already explained this to you in detail before on another occasion. All the material substances in the human body are completely renewed or replaced in a period of 7 or 8 years. The old substances, such as cells, are completely exchanged for new ones. Nothing of that which once was there is there later. So you can say that your friend, if you see him once again after 10 years, has none of the physical substances within himself that he once had when you saw him 10 years ago. But you recognized him, nevertheless. And if you look at him externally, he does appear to you as that same interrelated mass of substances. Yes, he does appear familiar in this way. But if you were to examine him using a sufficiently large magnifying glass, then you would see that, Table 7, upper middle, somewhere in his head, blood flows through an artery. And when this blood is magnified to a certain point, Table 7, upper right, it no longer looks like blood, but rather like many tiny dots that resemble small animals. These tiny dots are constantly quivering and trembling. When you look at this, you will see a great similarity between it and a horde of bees swarming about. A human being has the appearance of a swarm of bees when you magnify sufficiently the substances contained in the body. Once you gained a proper insight into all of this, it would have to seem incomprehensible that one human being could recognize another after 10 years, because not a single one of these tiny moving points is still there. His eyes now have completely new, quote-unquote, dots. There are new, different little animals in there, and yet a human being will recognize another after a long separation. It isn't absolutely necessary for these individual tiny animals and plants of which we consist, to be responsible for doing something that makes it possible for us to recognize each other after a long separation. But it is, rather, due to the fact that we recognize the whole person. Likewise, the beehive isn't simply what you would call a collection of an undetermined number of bees, but rather a complete whole, a complete being. That which you can recognize again or not recognize again is the entire beehive. If you could zoom out rather than zoom in, you could see all these bees at once and connect them in what would resemble a human muscle. With bees, this is the very thing you must pay attention to, that the object of our concern has nothing to do with the individual bees, but rather with that which absolutely belongs together to make up the whole. This is something that a simple understanding of the matter can't fathom. In this case, you must be able to view the whole as it must really be. That is why we can learn so much from a beehive or things like it, because a beehive completely contradicts the thoughts we may form about it. Our thoughts keep trying to tell us that the explanation must be different. However, in a beehive, the most wonderful things happen. It isn't the way our common understanding of the matter tells us. So, what happens when the change brought about by the death of the beekeeper affects the beehive in a certain way? This can't be denied. It simply happens this way, experience tells us. Someone who is not restricted to one beekeeping operation, but sees many such operations, is able to observe this as a fact. I can tell you, for example, that as a boy, I had numerous personal experiences relating to beekeeping, and at that time my interest in this matter was extremely great, not because of any connection beekeeping had to economic or commercial questions that interested me after I grew up, but rather because honey was prohibitively expensive at that time, so that my parents, who were poor, could never afford to buy any. Whatever honey we had came from our neighbors, usually for Christmas, but we received so much throughout the winter that we had enough honey for the entire year. At that time, I wasn't interested in the economic question regarding honey, since I ate almost exclusively honey that had been given as a present. How can this be? Nowadays, under the same conditions, you would not so easily receive honey as present. But back then, in the surrounding area where my parents lived, the beekeepers were primarily farmers who had made beekeeping part of the entire agricultural operation. This is quite a different situation compared to an individual purchasing whatever a beekeeping operation requires, and add to this the fact that such a person usually is a salaried worker who has to live entirely from hourly wages. In an agricultural operation, beekeeping is carried on in such a way that you don't even notice it. Hardly any consideration is even given to the length of time spent in this activity, because it is something that the farmer somehow manages to find time to do. In farming, there is always something that is left over to do. The time spent on such a job may be saved elsewhere, or perhaps a certain task for some reason is scheduled for a different time, thereby freeing one up to do something else. In any case, the hives were tended somewhere in between other chores back then, and the people knew that honey was something so valuable you couldn't even pay for it. And this, in a certain sense, is absolutely right, because under the present economic conditions, everything you can buy suffers from an improper relationship of price as related to the actual work done. Today we really ought not to be discussing these false price relationships, because such a discussion must really be placed upon a much broader basis of political economy. You'll not gain much of an insight if you treat honey as just another item on a grocery list, rather than a luxury item like coffee, tea, or chocolate. If the organization of a society were a healthy one, then without a doubt a proper price for honey would be established. It is just because we are not living under healthy social conditions that all the questions we raise will be tainted by the situation we are part of. You see, here is the situation today when you visit large farms. Yes, gentlemen, with the agricultural manager, usually this person is not a farmer, but an accountant-type manager, says to you about the quantity of milk obtained from cows is horrible. The manager gets so many liters of milk a day from a single cow. Anyone who really understands the nature of a cow knows that it is impossible that you can get this much milk from a cow, but they manage somehow to get this amount. As far as I know, some of them have pushed this amount to be double that which a cow can normally give. This brings in a good profit for the farm, naturally. And to top it off, you can't even say that you would be able to notice that the milk doesn't have the same nutritional value as the milk that is produced under natural conditions. You can't even prove that something really bad has happened to it. But let me give you the following example. Over the past few years, we have done many experiments with a medication used to treat hoof and mouth disease in cattle. Footnote regarding this remedy, see Josef Weyr's title Animal Husbandry and Animal Medicine in the Framework of Biodynamic Agriculture, Stuttgart, 1953. End of footnote. These experiments were conducted on large farms, as well as small ones, where the milk production for each cow was lower. You could find out all sorts of things because you had to try out the medication. The experiments were not completed because officially the people didn't want to comply with all aspects, and because today so many concessions have to be made. But the medication produced some extraordinary results. In a somewhat changed form, it is used as a medication to treat canine distemper. When you do these experiments, you'll discover the following. Calves born to cows that are forced to produce too much milk are considerably weaker. You can observe this in the effect the medication has on the calf. The effectiveness or lack of effectiveness is greatly magnified. Eventually, the calf grows up if it doesn't die of the disease. But a calf whose mother has been overfed in order to force it to give more milk is a much weaker calf than one whose mother was not forced to produce as much milk. You can observe this in the first, second, third, and fourth generations. Then the calf gets to be so small that you hardly notice it. This type of forced milk production has not been in existence for very long, but I know one thing very well, that if people continue along this path, if a single cow is made to deliver over 30 liters of milk a day, if they continue to mistreat these animals this way, then after some time, dairy farming may come to a bitter end. There's nothing that can be done about that. Well, to be sure, things are naturally not quite so bad with the artificial feeding and breeding of bees. This is mainly so because the bee is an animal that always knows how to help itself, since it is much closer to nature than a cow, which really can't help itself very much when it is raised and treated in this way. And this ability to help itself out of difficult situations is a truly wonderful thing about a beehive. Now we're getting to the point that Mr. Müller made about the hornets he sometimes finds inside his hives, hornets that don't sting him, whereas any other time a person meets up with a hornet, terrible things can happen. I also want to tell you something else. I don't know if you've had this experience yourself. Those of you who are beekeepers will know about this. But it can happen that you find yourself in a situation that forces you to empty out the entire hive. Well, once I looked into such an empty hive and saw something rather strange there. It looked like a tuber. Draws on blackboard, see table 7, lower right. No one really knew what it was. The bees seemed to have made this tuber for no reason at all. It was made of all the usual substances that bees are capable of producing. Looking like a stone, this tuber consisted of resins, waxes, and glue-like substances. Yes, gentlemen, I was truly curious about what was going on in there, and when I took the tuber apart, lo and behold, a dead mouse was inside. This mouse had gotten into the hive and died there. And then imagine how terrible the stench of the rotting corpse of the mouse must have been for the bees. In this very extraordinary case, the entire hive had the instinct to surround this dead mouse with a shell. When we took apart the surrounding shell, there was really a terrible smell that had remained inside it until that moment. As you can see, in the whole hive, there was not only an instinct to build cells and to feed the young, but also an instinct to do something when an event so unusual happens, like a mouse entering a hive. Since they were unable to remove the mouse from the hive, they helped themselves by creating a shell around it. I've heard from other beekeepers about snails and slugs that managed to get into the hive and were encrusted there. Alive within the hive are not only the usual instincts, but also instincts that help to heal. These are particularly effective. Well, if a hornet's nest is inside the hive, then the bees do not create such a solid structure, but they continually surround this nest with a secretion of their poison, and for this reason the hornets lose the energy, the power, even to attempt to escape. As with the dead mouse, which no longer creates a stench in all directions, the hornet, even though it hasn't been encrusted in a shell, lives continually in the poisonous vapors with which the bees surround themselves, so that the hornet becomes weak and can do them no harm. In this way, the hornet eventually loses its power and energy, and it can no longer defend itself if you approach it. You will get on well with bees only if you go beyond the normal basic understanding of things and actually begin to follow matters with an inner eye, EYE. The picture of things you get in this way is indeed wonderful. Using this type of insight, you'll have to say that a beehive is a total entity. You must try to understand it in its totality. And with such an entity, the potential damage is not at all noticeable right away. Whoever knows human beings well knows, for instance, that one 65 or 66-year-old individual still might have a rather fresh appearance, but another may not be as healthy in appearance because the second one suffers from hardening of the arteries or something like that. To observe this fact and to make a connection between what happened in childhood and later adulthood is extremely interesting. You can, for example, give a child milk that comes from cows that derive too much of their nourishment from plants growing in a soil with a high lime content. In this way, the child assimilates, through the cow's milk it drinks, some of the calcium present in the calcareous soil. This calcium intake probably will not manifest itself immediately. Along comes a medical doctor of the modern day sort and shows you one such child who was raised on milk from a cow that had grazed on land with a predominant lime content, and another child who had received only mother's milk. And such a doctor says, quote, "It doesn't make any difference which type of milk the child gets," unquote. But it turns out that the child raised on mother's milk is still fresh in appearance at an age of 65 or 66, and the other raised on cow's milk has suffered from calcification at the same age. Such a thing happens because a human being is a complete entity, and whatever is effective at a given time may still have after effects at a much later time. Something might be quite healthy at one time, but it will still show after effects later. And this is just what I'm trying to say. There is no way, based on the current situation with the artificial methods used in feeding and breeding bees, to predict what the significance of these procedures will mean for the future, 50 or 60 years or even a century from now. The fact that someone will say, "I don't understand how things like this would be any different in 50, 60, or 100 years from now," certainly is understandable. This inability to understand, or lack of desire to gain a deeper insight, this is just what I observed once on a large farm. You can rest assured that they really discouraged me in a very friendly manner when I began to talk about reducing the amount of milk taken from each cow. Dairy farming will suffer much faster. It will probably approach a ruinous state in a quarter of a century. Today it is impossible to object in any way to the artificial methods applied in beekeeping. This is because we live in social conditions that do not allow anything else to be done. Nevertheless, it is important to gain this insight that it is one matter if you let nature take its course and only help to steer it in the right direction when necessary. But it is entirely another matter if you apply artificial methods to speed things along. But I really don't want to take a strong position against what Mr. Mueller has stated. It is quite correct that we can't determine these matters today. It will have to be delayed until a later time. Let's talk to each other again in 100 years, Mr. Mueller. Then we'll see what kind of opinion you'll have at that point. This is something that can't be decided today. And now there's a mention. Mr. Erbsmell indicates once again that with beekeepers today, everything they do is based upon profit. And Dr. Steiner responds, The more you find that somebody is involved in beekeeping as a sideline, the more such a person will have the same opinion that the Spaniard you mentioned had. Well, today this will probably no longer be a common situation, but 50 or 60 years ago, a farmer did not regard with any particular value what was collected from the bees. It was always something a farmer didn't count on. The honey was given away for free, or if it was actually sold, the farmer would put the money in the children's piggy banks or something like that. Today, conditions have become quite different from what they once were. How could you imagine that someone whose wages are based upon working by the hour, or who talks about circumstances in terms of time being money, would not be primarily interested in profit? Such individuals arrive at this attitude through all the conditions under which they live. It's true, is it not, that these days there are hobby beekeepers who must interrupt their salaried work and take a vacation without pay in order to conduct their beekeeping activities properly. Then they sit down and calculate their honey price. They calculate into their honey price the money they lost from their normal salaried position. Just imagine, beekeeping is so old that no one can provide any physical proof of the way it was prior to the domestication of bees. For the most part, people know only about our bees, the European honeybee. Their only acquaintance is with the domesticated bee. In natural history textbooks, you can even find the type of bee found throughout Europe referred to as the common house bee. Footnote: this term was first used by Alfred Brehm in Brehm's Illustrated Animal Life, Volume 3, Leipzig, 1875, page 474, into footnote. It is truly remarkable that people know only of the domesticated bee and have no idea what conditions were like when these bees were found in a wild, natural state, entirely exposed to the forces of nature. We can assume that the domestication of bees reaches very far back into history. As you begin to discuss such ancient matters, consider that the prices of things were very different from those that prevail today. Just remember that people today work in jobs that you can trace back to the time when they originated. But here you have two types of price formation. With bees, this goes back to very ancient antiquity. There are no ancient recorded prices to compare with today's prices, as in the metal and lumber industries, which have price lists going back a number of decades. Only when healthy social conditions once again prevail will the proper price of honey arise in accordance with the new and different conditions existing at that future time. Most people simply have no idea, nor can they imagine how difficult it is to discuss price formation or how prices are fixed. In order to talk about these matters, you need a very thorough understanding of the actual conditions that exist. Recently, I had an interesting experience that I want to tell you about, because it may cause you to wonder about price formation. A university professor I know wrote a book about political economy. He gave me a copy of the book while I was on a lecture tour. I stayed in one place for 2 or 3 days and had time to talk to him, and I told him that I would look at the book, but naturally not read it entirely. Well, I looked at the book and told him the following, quote, "I've noticed that you have included an index, something that normally repels me, but in this case I found it very helpful. This index contains, of course, a list of subjects you've discussed in the book." Well, I immediately look up the word price, and would you believe it, there was nothing at all on that subject, unquote. How can this educated man write a book on political economy and not include anything in it on the subject of price? Yes, gentlemen, this is very typical. Today, political economists are not even capable of seeing the most important problem in political economy. They simply omit the problem of price formation. It is very important, but people don't seem to recognize it. When a thing like this happens, it becomes even more apparent that something is wrong. In this case, you will simply have to hope that little by little, people will come to the conclusion that healthier social conditions must be initiated. Then I think there will not be so much concentration on the profit motive, the bottom line. These are concepts that are connected with the idea of competition. It may not necessarily be the competition between those who make similar products, but rather between those who produce different products. If you were to look back into my youth and examine beekeeping practices in the region where I lived, where only farmers tended bees, well, those farmers were rather corpulent. I can't even say that anyone here is as fat as those farmers were. The price of honey was of such a nature that no one would have even considered beekeeping as a sole occupation in order to sell honey for money. If the beekeeper had placed himself next to the farmer, it would have looked like this. Drawing below, see also table 7, the middle. This would be the farmer, and that the beekeeper. It simply wouldn't have worked out. The farmer wouldn't have had to include the cost of beekeeping in his expenses, whereas the beekeeper would have. This situation would have been intolerable. This is why it is so important to understand political economy and include it in your considerations when you start talking about making a profit. Now, I'd like to answer a few questions about the subjects we have just discussed. Now, there's some comments. Someone says that there are some people who simply can't tolerate any honey at all. They immediately suffer from heartburn and indigestion. Is there any medication that might control this negative effect of honey? Dr. Steiner replies, people of the type that can't tolerate any honey are usually those who tend toward getting sclerosis, an inclination toward hardening throughout the entire body, which causes the body's metabolic rate to be quite slow. This is why they can't tolerate honey, the primary effect of which is to increase the metabolic rate. Within their bodies, a split in their metabolism occurs when their bodies want an abnormally slow metabolism and the honey makes it faster. As a result, they get indigestion, which manifests itself in a number of different ways. Every person should be able to enjoy eating some honey. By that I mean not only to enjoy the honey, but to have the inner ability to digest it properly. If you have before you people who can't tolerate honey, you should, above all, determine the causes or origins of these conditions. You shouldn't be thinking of finding a general cure or a single medicinal remedy, but rather you must attempt to determine on an individual basis how a person came to develop such a sclerotic condition, and then base the cure upon this knowledge. The following case might serve as an example. Say, for instance, someone is unable to tolerate honey and gets indigestion when attempting to eat it. You need to ask yourself whether this person experiences indigestion when eating honey because the individual tends toward hardening of the arteries, veins, and blood vessels in the head, which is called a head sclerosis. It is possible that at a certain age, such a person will not be able to tolerate honey. In a case such as this, the cure will be effected by giving a preparation containing phosphorus. Then the person will begin tolerating honey, if you can bring about a cure in this way. But it can also happen that you'll notice that the sclerotic condition is in the lungs. Then you'll need to use not a preparation containing phosphorus, but one containing sulfur. This is what I wanted to say about this matter. It is important not to lump all these conditions together and to ask a general question about how to treat someone who gets indigestion from honey, but rather to say to yourself that if someone can't tolerate honey at a given age, it is evidence of illness. A healthy person can tolerate honey without any problems. If someone doesn't tolerate it, that person is ill. And you must seek the nature of the illness and cure it. Not to be able to tolerate honey isn't as serious as not being able to tolerate sugar, such as in the condition of diabetes mellitus. This type of diabetic condition is naturally much more serious than not being able to tolerate honey. A diabetic person is truly ill, and you need to treat this illness. Now some more comments. Someone asks, just like most insects, bees fly out of the darkness toward the light of a candle lamp. Some experienced beekeepers have told me repeatedly that bees react much less toward electric light. If you approach bees with a flashlight, they remain very calm, as if they don't even see this light. Only after some time has passed do they become restless. Petroleum lamps and candlelight attract them faster, and also in greater numbers. Is there an explanation for this behavior? Mr. Mueller states that he has observed the same reactions. Dr. Steiner responds, "Well, gentlemen, you may have observed in the first Goetheanum, before it was destroyed by fire, that the insides of the domes were painted in various colors. These colors were made from pure natural plant substances. As a result, these same colors, had they been exposed to sunlight shining in, would have faded and become pale after a certain period of time, perhaps months or even years. Then you would not have seen what had been painted there. If you had exposed them to electric light, they would have remained. So the painters painted with this in mind. You can also see that sunlight, which has the ability to bring about chemical changes, and you said that the bee notices this, has a very different effect than electric light does. Electric light has much more of a hardening effect on all substances. It doesn't dissolve or break apart substances as sunlight does. Because of this, a bee experiences a very slight rigidity or paralysis when exposed to electric light, a reaction it does not have in sunlight. Of course, it quickly recovers from this condition. That's what I wanted to say about that." Some more comments. Someone asks, "With regard to the influence that the signs of the zodiac can have on the production of honey, in some older traditional farming communities, the farmers still pay close attention to this. For instance, when they sow the seed, they do so when the moon is in Gemini and so on. Are they superficially following the characteristics of the signs of the zodiac, or is there something else that might be meaningful?" Dr. Steiner replies, "Things of this type are naturally never properly examined in a scientific manner these days, even though it is possible to do so. I've already indicated to you what has an influence on the beehive. A bee, and specifically the queen, is to a certain degree a sun animal. As a result, the sun, as it moves through the zodiac, has the greatest influence upon bees. The changes the sun undergoes as it moves through each sign are transmitted to the bee. But the bees are, naturally, also dependent on that which they find in plants. And this is where there is a connection between the farmer's sowing of the seed under a certain sign of the zodiac and the bees' finding of substances the plants have prepared for them. Such things aren't simply pulled out of nowhere. However, the way they are normally presented is very amateurish and misleading. These matters must be properly examined in a scientific manner, so that they will have a firm foundation. With that, we've used up the time allotted to us today. Whatever still remains to be discussed, we'll take up again next Saturday at 9 o'clock. I can imagine that many of you will still have questions to bring up at that time. Beekeeping is such a beautiful and useful endeavor that there is no way that one can ask too many questions about it. Ask questions among yourselves, and ask Mr. Mueller and me. I think we'll be able to find a way to build a bridge between the differing opinions. We don't have to resort immediately to stinging the way bees do. We can settle these differences in a gentle and friendly atmosphere. But we shouldn't hold back with our questions either. Footnote about the lecture next Saturday at 9 o'clock. This announced lecture actually took place on Monday, December 10th, 1923. And that is the end of Lecture 4.